From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. Republican critics are blasting President Biden's decision to pull American troops out of Afghanistan earlier than expected on August 31st. Senator Lindsey Graham calls it a disaster in the making, and former Trump National Security Advisor John Bolton says it's a mistake across the board.
Afghanistan is just one of the tough issues that the president has been grappling with this week. He spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin today about cyber attacks that have been originating in Russia. It's time for our Friday Politics Roundtable. Kimberly Atkins-Store is a Boston Globe opinion columnist. Kimberly, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. And Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Rick, it's good to speak with you again as well.
Great to be with you.
So yesterday, President Biden said he's pulling out troops from Afghanistan after 20 years because the U.S. did not go there to nation build. Let's listen.
So let me ask those who want us to stay, how many more, how many thousands more Americans, daughters and sons, were you willing to risk? How long would you have them stay?
Rick, President Biden has appeared consistently confident that ending the U.S. involvement in this war is the right decision. Do you think that's true, politically speaking?
Well, he's the third straight president.
I think we might have just lost Rick there. Kimberly, why don't you pick it up if you can?
Well, yeah. So I think where he was getting at is that this has been a bipartisan push by several presidents to draw down, if not completely remove, troops from Afghanistan. And on the justification that the solution there is political and that it's based on the Afghan people, it is not political. It is not military, a military solution. But it's difficult. I think the one thing that is different now is that the situation in Afghanistan in recent years and months has deteriorated in a way. The Taliban is on the march in increasing strength, particularly in the northern territories. And there is a real fear that a full troop pullout now could lead to catastrophe. And President Biden is sticking firm to his plan, saying that he has faith that the Afghan military and the Afghan people will be able to prevail. But it is. It's hard to say that this is an easy decision. It certainly isn't. But at the same time, you more than 2,000 U.S. troops have died there in the last 20 years. And so one of Joe Biden's justifications is how many more sons and daughters of Americans should give their lives.
Right. And we do have Rick Klein back on the line. So, Rick, I'm going to go back to you now. There was this moment yesterday when a reporter asked the president or mentioned to the president that U.S. intelligence agencies have said that the Afghan government could collapse as soon as 6 months after American troops leave. The president kind of strongly disputed that, said that was not what the assessment was. Either way, do you think he will have to answer for what happens in Afghanistan after August 31st?
He owns this now, and people won't care that Donald Trump wanted to move troops out faster. People won't care about the history. As he said, this isn't about the last 20 years. It's about the next 20 years. So, yes, if there's a backsliding, if the Taliban continues to take territory, if terrorists set up camp there, he will have to answer for that. And I think his answer about arming the Afghan troops is just not going to be sufficient. That isn't the state of the Afghan army. We've seen troubling reports already about people giving up territory, giving up arms. He's going to have to make some tough decisions down the road. And you could tell he was asked also whether this is a mission accomplished moment. The way he pushed back at that yes, we've accomplished the mission, but he doesn't want a victory lap. It's so telling. I feel like he's trying to grapple with the legacy of America's longest war in real time.
We're talking more about Afghanistan elsewhere in the show, so I do want to get to another security issue that's not so much on the ground as it is in cyberspace, Kimberly Atkins, because the president was on the phone with the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, today talking about ransomware attacks from groups that are based in Russia. Biden vowed to take any necessary action to defend the U.S. while also promising what he called continued engagement. What's the line he's trying to walk with Russia right now?
Well, certainly he wants to be strong and forceful in these attacks, both attacks that are attributed to Russian officials themselves, as well as those by non-state actors who are given shield and protection from Russia. But at the same time, engaging in a full-fledged war, so to speak, cyber war with Russia could come with its own repercussions. Whatever the United States does to escalate against Russia can be done back against against it as well. And so I think that's where you see this engagement, this fine line that's walking. Look, there's a lot we don't know about what the U.S. is doing to retaliate, since so much of that are covert efforts. But then there's a question, should it be something that is a little more more public for people to see? Should there be sanctions against, for example, banks that fund some of these folks who are seen engaging in some of the cybersecurity or others? So it is a tight rope that he is walking, but it's still very different from the predecessor, who was really loath to say anything negative about Russia and said believed everything Vladimir Putin said.
And Rick Klein, just to fill in a little bit more of the context here, this comes after the president met with his cybersecurity advisors this week following another wave of these Russia-linked cyber attacks. They were targeting a wide range of U.S. businesses, a Florida defense contractor, maybe even the Republican National Committee. Biden has said that attacks on what he calls critical infrastructure would be his red line. So how close to that red line are we getting, Rick?
Oh, very. I mean, I think you can define critical infrastructure in a number of different ways. But when you talk about how people live their lives, the gas they get, the food they access, it's almost unfathomable. And I think the hack on a server associated with the Republican National Committee is almost the ultimate troll, because we know how politically charged that is and the history of hacking with the DNC. It demands some kind of a response. You're seeing that response. And this is another area where President Biden was pretty clear. He wasn't certain, as he said as much, that he was able to change Vladimir Putin's behavior, change his mind about everything. He said he did his best and time will tell. And this is a troubling development. There's no question, a much more complicated, nuanced reaction than he demanded at the time.
Rick, isn't it also clear that there was no chance that Vladimir Putin wasn't going to test that line and to test Joe Biden?
Oh, I think that's exactly right. And I think Biden knew that. We remember the almost the diplomatic trash talk that went in the run up to that summit. And Biden was clear eyed about it. He didn't think that Putin would suddenly be open to a reset or a new start. He's been very clear in his assessment. And yes, I think this is expected, although the fact that there has to be a response can never really be fully baked into that cake. It's difficult to respond in kind in this scenario.
Kimberly, let's switch over to voting rights. On MSNBC, the Reverend Al Sharpton spoke before a meeting that he and other civil rights leaders had with President Biden earlier this week on that issue.
We want to see how aggressive this president is going to be with us. We know he has said the right things, but now the speechifying, as I would say, is over. Oratory must now turn into real action and boots on the ground.
As we know, Republican-controlled state legislatures are passing restrictive voting laws. Democrats in Congress are not yet unified on a national bill to counter those state laws. Do you sense some growing impatience within his own party over the president's inability so far to get this issue over the finish line?
I think that's absolutely true. You see civil rights leaders have been increasingly pressing not just members of Congress to act on voting rights, but also President Biden to use his bully pulpit to really push harder, to push his own party to get something going. I mean, the president has been focused on so many things, from the cybersecurity to infrastructure, which has taken up a lot of the oxygen of his agenda right now. But they want him to use that bully pulpit. He is going to address voting rights next week. I think he's listening to them, and that's part of that push. Certainly, Democrats in states are saying, look, the Democrats in Texas walked out of their legislature to try to stop more restrictive voting rules from being passed. They're doing everything that they can do against a solidified Republican effort to push these laws. They want Democrats in Washington on Capitol Hill to do more. So the pressure is coming from all sides. The question is whether it will have any impact on Democrats like Joe Manchin, who have just drawn the line and really refused to consider lifting the filibuster, which is what would be required to pass any of these bills.
And we do see the vice president using her pulpit as well. The Vice President Kamala Harris said yesterday in a speech that the Democratic National Committee is going to spend $25 million on voter education and turnout efforts. And then in an interview with BET, she was asked if she would support a bill that would require voters to show ID at the polls.
People have to understand that when we're talking about voter ID laws, be clear about who you have in mind and what would be required of them to prove who they are. Of course, people have to prove who they are. but not in a way that makes it almost impossible for them to prove who they are.
Rick Klein, that sounds like a very skinny needle she's trying to thread there. In the moment that we have left, what do you think she can actually get done?
Well, Democrats have shifted on this and are more open to voter ID if you were able to define it as like utility bill and not just a driver's license of photo identification. But this reflects how difficult this is for Democrats. They're going to have to give some ground if they're going to get something done in Congress. And that's hard ground to give because a lot of the gains that they've had in the past have been pretty hard fought.
Okay. Rick Klein is political director at ABC News. Rick, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Also with us was Kimberly Atkins-Store, Boston Globe opinion columnist. Kim, always fun.
Thank you.
The Taliban claim today that they now control 85% of Afghanistan. The announcement comes on the heels of President Biden's announcement yesterday that the American military operation in Afghanistan will end on August 31st. In his remarks at the White House, Biden pushed back against the idea that the 20-year U.S. mission was a failure.
As I said in April, the United States did what we went to do in Afghanistan, to get the terrorists to attack us on 9/11, and deliver justice to Osama bin Laden.
Jim Walsh is here and now, security analyst. He's with MIT's Security Studies program. Jim, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Peter.
And despite what we just heard from the president, this really was not a mission accomplished moment, was it?
Well, I think you and I have talked about this before. Anytime you go into a war, you should ask yourself a couple of questions. What is the objective? I can't underline that one enough. What is the objective? How do you know when we've reached it or not reached it? How much will it cost? How long will it take? And what are our odds of success? But we never enter wars asking those questions. We say, is the adversary evil? And we're big and strong so we can win. And so I think actually the president is right to ask what the objective was. And the objective was, in the aftermath of the attack on 9/11, to defeat and kill Osama bin Laden. And I think that was achieved. Now, what happens when you get into wars that last decades and decades is then the objective begins to shift. You know, it widens. Now it's to rebuild Afghanistan and make it a star of democracy, in Asia. Or it's other sorts of objectives, the battling the drug trade or supporting human rights.
And in fact, the president made the point yesterday that he has no interest in nation building in Afghanistan.
Well, nation building is hard. I mean, there are some longstanding truths in international security. One is it's easier to tear up a nuclear agreement than to negotiate a new one. It's easier to get in a war than to get out of one. And certainly the last one is it's very hard for foreigners, to do nation building.
Right. The former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Ryan Crocker, told NPR earlier this week that the United States would bear, he said, a huge responsibility if the Taliban end up taking control of Afghanistan. Again, here he is.
Right now, it's the Taliban who has agency here. We gave ours up. So it's up to them whether they're going to pursue an all-out offensive or whether they'll take a more moderate tack. But leaving it up to the Taliban is not a good place to be right now.
Jim, what do you make of that statement? To me, it sounds like he's saying the Taliban in some ways is already in control of Afghanistan, or at the very least, the future isn't really up to the Afghan government.
Well, if you're asking me which is the stronger party right now on the ground, then I would agree that certainly by almost every estimation, the Taliban is in a better position to advance its objectives on the ground going forward. And they're already starting to do that. And we see reports about that every day. Now, let me be clear. I think the world of Ambassador Crocker, he is a national treasure. And I've benefited from every conversation I've had with him. But he's wrong here. We're not in charge of everything in the world. At some point, Afghans have to take responsibility for Afghanistan. You know, and we've been there for 20 years. How much longer would the dear ambassador want us to stay? I've asked him that question. He's willing to stay, you know, for eternity. I'm not willing to support that as a public policy. You know, I just disagree with that. Now, he is right to say And we should all expect that there are going to be harsh consequences from this decision. But that's the real world. That's the adult world of consequences. And whether you get in or you get out, there are going to be consequences.
Well, in considering those consequences, what does the United States owe the Afghan people, if anything, when this mission officially ends now at the end of August?
Well, I think pretty much everyone agrees that we, at a minimum, owe something to the Afghan men and women who helped us and who are now going to be in jeopardy if, in fact, the Taliban takes over. And so I think we do have a moral obligation to resettle those folks if they want to leave and their families, because I do think we have a moral obligation there that we do something for the folks who worked intimately with American forces and helped protect their lives. We have an obligation to do something for them as well.
And the U.S. government does say that it will make that happen. But Jim, if this move signals a significant shift in policy and resources away from the Middle East, where should the attention shift now?
Well, for a long time, even prior to the Obama administration, so we're going back, you know, 12 years, there's been this talk about the pivot to Asia. We're going to get out of these messy wars in the Middle East. We're going to get out of Iraq, get out of Afghanistan, get out of Syria, and shift our attention to East Asia, and in particular China. And at one level, you know, I think that makes a lot of sense. But I think we tend to forget our good friends, the Europeans, in all this. And Europe still represents one of the biggest islands of prosperity and democracy in the world. So I think we should spend some time rebuilding our relations with our good friends who share our values. But obviously, China is a rising power, a lot of economic growth in East Asia. But we can't go with the same mindset. If pivoting to Asia means, well, now we're going to make China the enemy and seek a war with China or seek a Cold War with China, that doesn't make any sense either. The question is not only where do you shift new resources now that you're getting out of one place, but also how you do it. You know, how we act in Asia can be self-defeating or it can advance our goals. So, yes, we have, in theory, have more resources, although I think a lot of that's going to come back home, right? We've been facing a recession. We have COVID. A lot of the focus is going to be on at home. But insofar as we shift some of that elsewhere, I hope it's to Europe and to East Asia, but with a frame of mind that works rather than one that is going to lead to, again, negative consequences and failed objectives.
Jim Walsh, here and now security analyst with MIT's Security Studies program. Jim, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
A new pilot program from TikTok is helping job seekers apply online to open positions with video resumes. Think of that scene from the 2001 movie Legally Blonde, in which Reese Witherspoon's character applies to Harvard Law School with a video essay.
Oh, hi. My name is Elle Woods, and for my admissions essay, I'm going to tell all of you at Harvard why I'm going to make an amazing lawyer.
She got in, by the way, and she was ahead of her time because several companies are now seeking video resumes, much like Elle Woods on TikTok, to recruit Gen Z. Let's bring in Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. She helps us break down trends and culture on social media every Friday. Mm-hmm. Hi, Femi.
Hi there, Callum.
So first, can you explain a little bit more about how this TikTok resumes program works?
All right. So TikTok, as we know, is a great platform for content creators, fun, entertaining videos. And now TikTok are exploring a pilot program to see if it could be a recruitment platform as well. So all the companies who are taking part have agreed to accept the TikTok video resumes. And if you are a candidate or a would-be candidate, all you need to do is submit a creative, brief video resume. Tag it using TikTok resumes and the recruiters will find you. And I'm going to add one more thing. Also tag the company as well, because this hashtag is blowing up. Let me give you an example. Big Sean is a singer. He's a songwriter and a rapper and the creative director of innovation for the Detroit Pistons. He has an opening for an intern. So he posted this video on TikTok.
I'm looking for someone passionate, someone that's about that basketball culture. You can put your resume on TikTok right now.
Sounds like a cool internship, Femi, although that is pretty entry level. So what kind of jobs are we talking about here? And who besides the Pistons is participating in this program on TikTok?
36 other companies, and I have gone through every single job, so there's a huge range. And if my boss is listening, I was just looking through the jobs for research purposes. But the range of jobs from hairstylist openings at the Great Clips salons across the whole of the nation to vice president of global operations at the international ad company Zenith, And then one job, Callum, stop me scrolling. WWE superstar. That's the job vacancy. The ideal candidate possesses world-class athleticism, personality and charisma, coachability, work ethic and professionalism. You can put your TikTok resume in and apply to the WWE, Callum.
I mean, pro wrestling and TikTok, a marriage made in heaven, Femi. How's it going so far, though? Early days. Do job seekers like this option so far to apply with their video resumes?
So I looked at the hashtag and it is trending. It's the top trending hashtag. More than 90 million views so far, just before I jumped on the radio with you. But what is also happening is that there's some hijacking of the hashtag. So people are thinking, wow, this is a very popular hashtag. Let me jump on it, post my random video using TikTok resumes, and that will get eyeballs on it. Yes, that works. But there are real candidates generally searching for work, like Jade, who graduated from Howard University this year. And this is part of her TikTok resume.
I've been applying for jobs like crazy and I'm just keep getting denied. I'm trying to remind myself, delayed, not denied, but it doesn't look like I'm ever going to find a job. So these are all the things that I'm
interested in. Okay, Femi, I can hear the frustration there from Jade, but she's, you know, maybe stepping out of the box a little bit, putting herself out there with a video to supplement the traditional resume. Kind of reminds me of walking into a place in person in the old days to shake a hand and say, can I have a job? So in the moment we have left, I'm wondering if you think companies will like this too, and if this trend has staying power.
I just checked the Equal Opportunity Employment Opportunity Commission, excuse me, EEOC, and they said yes, they can, and companies can use these video resumes, but they have to be careful of bias, either a bias that you know about or bias that you don't know about. So that might be the one thing that slows down what it looks like it could be a trend. But if we see Instagram and other platforms beginning to have resumes and video resumes, we know it's a success.
All right. Keep an eye on it for us, Femi. That's Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Three years ago, a man with a grudge murdered five people at the Capital Gazette newspaper in Maryland. And now, finally, his trial has started. What we wanted to know was, how did the staff who survived the shooting keep going? Find out in our Capital Gazette series from NPR's Embedded podcast.
Cartoonist Sandra Boynton is a publishing phenomenon. Since the 1970s, she's produced thousands of greeting cards featuring quirky animals who are almost human. Many like to make puns and eat chocolate. Boynton has also created more than 50 books and several music albums, including 2002's Grammy-nominated Philadelphia Chickens, on which stars like Meryl Streep sing Boynton's offbeat lyrics.
Nobody understands me, though mammally blit each day. Nobody understands me, but I guess Zook Lobble that way.
Now Sandra Boynton has taken her talents to jigsaw puzzles, and she joins us to talk about them. Welcome.
Thank you.
So jigsaw puzzles might seem kind of old-fashioned, but they really had a resurgence during the pandemic. Is that why you decided to make a few of your own?
It is. I couldn't help but notice everyone that I knew was doing jigsaw puzzles, and I thought, well, I'm not very good at doing the jigsaw puzzles, but I might be able to design some, so that's what I did.
We'll try to describe them. We're on the radio, of course, but they're funny, quirky designs. It's a 1,000-piece puzzle in which you have to search for hidden cows, a 500-piece puzzle featuring these complaining chickens. They're complaining about how the puzzle is too hard or too easy, or I need more pieces. Where did the idea come from?
The idea for that particular one, which is called Puzzle Complaints, is when I was working with the publisher, which is Workman, on them, and I did some submissions. And the reactions I got back from different people were all over the board. It needs more space. It needs less space. It needs... So at a certain point, I did that puzzle as a joke. I sent it to them in response to, you know, all right, here are all the complaints I've been hearing. And to their credit, they loved it. And so that's one of the puzzles.
I love that. And it also feels kind of like an inside joke for avid puzzlers who may have the same complaints about puzzles in general if they've done many. I understand, Sandra, that your grandfather loved doing jigsaw puzzles. I wonder if that's something you did with him growing up and if that planted a seed for this most recent work of yours.
I did. I was not much help on them, but I loved help organizing like the edge pieces. You know, he'd give me the task of find the ones with the straight line. He was phenomenal at them. And I remember he even at one point did one that's called Bullseye, and it's just a huge red circle. He did it in no time. I mean, it seems an impossible puzzle to do. But he was a very precise person and had that kind of mind. My mind is a little more chaotic.
Well, the chaos comes through a little bit in some of the designs. I love the confetti and the streamers falling in this birthday puzzle. It's 300 pieces, and it's this very clever play on words. Instead of happy birthday to you, it says hippo birdie to yous, with a hippopotamus, a bird, and a couple of sheep. This is also probably your most popular greeting card design.
Oh my goodness, so many years ago. That was 1975, and it's still in print. It's been, as a card, it's been in print continuously since 1975. It's the most popular thing I've ever done. So really my life since then has been a complete failure, I think. Just, you know, you just can't seem to
you peaked early.
To compete with my younger self.
Well, one of the things I like about it, this is sort of nerdy, but I like the plays on words for kids as an educational tool. It's a chance to talk about, here are the variations of how you spell two, or here are the different ways that you spell deer, and they mean different things. So it's very clever. That's cartoonist Sandra Boynton. And to see some of these jigsaw puzzles, take a look at hereandnow.org. Sandra Boynton, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was nice to talk with you.
The country's largest reservoir is losing water, and it's happening fast. Lake Mead, along the Colorado River on the Arizona-Nevada border, is at its lowest level since it was filled in the 1930s. A bathtub ring left around the lakeshore shows visible evidence of its decline by more than 140 feet since the year 2000, when Lake Mead was last considered full. And now, millions of people in the Southwest are bracing for the first ever water shortage declaration along the river. Let's bring in John Fleck. He's director of the Water Resources Program at the University of New Mexico and co-author of the book Science Be Damned, How Ignoring Inconvenient Science Drained the Colorado River. Welcome.
It's so great to be here, and I'm so thankful that you're paying attention to this important story.
Yeah, and one of the reasons we're paying attention is because Lake Mead's water supply has dwindled so quickly over the past two decades. Help us understand, first of all, just how much water we're talking about.
So Lake Mead is a reservoir that provides water to millions of people all across San Diego, Los Angeles, the Phoenix, Tucson area, down into Mexico, and also agricultural water use around the Southwest that like grows all the lettuce they eat in the winter. It's all Colorado River water. We're talking about a huge volume of water that has just been dissipated because we have continued to use kind of a lot of water while less water is flowing in from upstream.
Right, because we're in this mega drought, and we've also more recently experienced these just awful heat waves just in the last couple of days. How do those things affect the level of water inside Lake Mead?
So we're in a position now where some of us who work on this issue are kind of steering away from the word drought even. And there's a broader and more meaningful and wonkier and harder to pronounce word that we use called aridification, meaning this place is just getting drier. So that when we get snow in the mountains, which is what feeds the Colorado River, less of that water melts and ends up in the rivers, more of it is evaporating on the way. And when you get this hot weather, more water evaporates from rivers and reservoirs. Plants take up more water. And this is the fundamental effect of climate change on the hydrologic cycle. It means for whatever rain or snow we get, we have less water to use down here in the valleys of the western United States where we need to use the water. This year was a remarkable example of that. We had a snowpack on the Rio Grande where I live that was close to normal. We have flows in our river about half of normal. We had an 80% snowpack on the Colorado River. The actual river flow is maybe 30% of normal. We're seeing far less water actually arrive at the reservoirs where we can then tap into it and use it for our farms and our cities.
I know you've studied this reservoir, Lake Mead, for a long time. How have you seen it change? And does it surprise you how empty it's gotten?
So I've been working on Colorado River issues for a couple of decades and really intensely for the last 10 years. And one of the things that I did was started going to Lake Mead just to see it. And, you know, it has this big bathtub ring, the minerals that are left behind as the reservoir drops. And the bathtub ring keeps getting bigger and bigger. And one of the things I do, there's like a particular boat ramp that I love to go visit near Las Vegas. And the National Park Service keeps having to extend the boat ramp, pour more concrete to get down to the water so the boaters can get in the water. You have this visceral realization that there is less and less and less water.
Yeah, we'll get to what it means in just a moment. But I mentioned the name of your book when I introduced you. It's called Science Be Damned, How Ignoring Inconvenient Science Drained the Colorado River. What do you mean by that? Could what you're describing have been avoided?
Yes. A century ago, there were scientists, especially from the U.S. Geological Survey, who were studying the Colorado River. And this was early days of the hydrologic science that we use to make societal decisions. And they looked back into the 1800s and they saw the glimmerings of evidence that there had been really, really big droughts. And at the time, the Colorado River was full because we have this sort of yin-yang cycle. You have a wet decade and a dry decade. And we were in the midst of a wet decade and people thought, plenty of water for all the things we want to do. And these scientists were saying, there really isn't as much water as you think. You have to recognize that big droughts do happen and they endure over long periods of time. These scientists were ignored because the science that they were offering up was inconvenient to the decision makers who wanted to be able to say to their local political communities, there's plenty of water to build this city, to build this farm district, to grow the communities that we want to grow. So they just ignored this inconvenient science. So they allocated more water on paper than the river can really actually provide. And that's before climate change. So even without climate change, we would have a big problem.
And by the way, the messaging today is exactly the same. You still hear cities and towns that are intent on growing and growing, and developers that are intent on building and building say, don't worry, there's plenty of water. There's plenty of water.
Right. And that's the tension. Because when you're saying that, the answer, of course, is yes, there's plenty of water if we're willing to take it from something that's already using the water now. But that isn't part of the discussion that we have. So we see people wanting to build additional pipelines to take more water out of the Colorado River, for example, of southern Utah, and pretending there's just a lot of water there as if it's available and they can use it without being frank about the reality that is, if we're going to send water to southern Utah, it's going to be coming from somewhere else. Someone else who's using it now won't have that water.
Right. An important part of this story happened in 2019. That's when states along the Colorado River agreed to a drought contingency plan, which meant that those states would be getting less water. They would agree to getting less water if things got bad along the river. Well, next month, in August, water managers from the Bureau of Reclamation are going to release some data. We're going to get a forecast, and we will see how bad it really is, and we'll see what the cuts are going to be. Can you explain what that might look like?
What they decided was Las Vegas will take early cutbacks, which Las Vegas is well positioned to handle. Las Vegas is an enormous water conservation success. And central Arizona also takes a big cut. And we know what's going to happen. There's farmers in central Arizona in the strip of land between Phoenix and Tucson, a place called Pinal County, who have been living off of heavily subsidized Colorado River water for a long time. And that subsidy and that water are going away and there will be less farming. And, you know, one of the things they can do is turn to groundwater to replace that. That's expensive and also fundamentally unsustainable.
So you say farmers are going to feel the impacts first. What about people in cities? Because I should point out again, and I've hinted at this, in places like Phoenix in the middle of the desert, no one is saying you've got to stop watering your lawn or cut back on your water use, for instance.
Yeah. So I actually think the cities are in pretty good shape. The cities have done a good job of doing two things. One, implementing conservation measures, paying people to tear out lawns, low-flow toilets, better plumbing fixtures. So the cities are essentially well-positioned. And, you know, that's for a reason. They're rich, they have the resources, and also the risks are enormous. But the cities are only using, you know, perhaps 10% of the water in the Colorado River Basin. You know, the real hurt is going to be on the farmers, and the choice is different. Like, I can just tear out my lawn and that changes my lifestyle slightly. If I'm a farmer, the equivalent of tearing out my lawn is farming less. And it's harder to conserve and reduce your use when you're farming as a result, because it's your livelihood and it's your cultural identity. And so,
well, it's also the food for the country. You know, that's the other thing. It hurts personally, yeah, but it hurts structurally.
Yeah, it is
well.
The food for the country, although I worry about that less. The food grown, and there's a sort of mythology about the scale of food produced in the Colorado River Basin, and it's probably a lot less than some people would like to say. So one of the things we have seen with these farm districts is when they have less water, we've seen the farmers be pretty effective at figuring out how to farm less acreage and use less water and still make a decent living. Again, the farmers are making a lot of money. They're clever. They will survive. They'll just have to do with less and less water. There are some places where they don't have as much flexibility, the places like Pinal County, where we may just see farming stop happening over the next few decades.
Well, and let's talk about the next few decades, because there is a point at which Lake Mead could get so low that water no longer flows through the dam and downstream along the Colorado River. Is that a reality that we should be thinking about and preparing for if this drought continues? I think the question is, you know, like, what is life going to be like?
Yeah, so that apocalyptic scenario would be a catastrophe. The decline in the river's flow over the last couple of years makes the things we'll have to do to prevent it more and more difficult. And the concern is that we don't move quickly enough. The steps we need to take in terms of near-term conservation will be painful. The longer we wait, the more painful they will be.
John Fleck is director of the Water Resources Program at the University of New Mexico, has been studying Lake Mead for many years. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Lebanon has suffered a lot in the past year. The pandemic, yes, but also a calamitous economic meltdown and an explosion at a Beirut port that destroyed entire swaths of the capital city. Now the country is on its knees. Public services have broken down. There are shortages of everything. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports on how this once cosmopolitan hub in the Middle East is becoming a dark place where even the once wealthy now struggle for the basics.
The signs of the collapse of this great city are everywhere. There are smashed up storefronts from the explosion last August still. Banks are all boarded up. Much of the country's famous restaurant scene is closed down. And even the traffic lights don't work. So every junction is this dangerous snarl of cars. People have to waste so many hours just trying to get the basics. Like Waleed Harouni, who we meet outside a pharmacy. He says this is the 7th or 8th pharmacy he's visited in search for medication for his sick relative. We follow him in, and he asks the pharmacist for the drugs, which include the usually common painkiller, Panadol. Impossible, the pharmacist tells him. This is the reality of pharmacies around Beirut. I've seen people in tears because they can't get the medicines they need, sometimes for really serious diseases like diabetes or cancer. Harouni says he wants to keep searching for his relative's medicines, but his Vespa scooter has run out of gas. And this is a problem because in Lebanon now, getting gas means waiting in line, sometimes in the blistering heat, for hours or a day. I go to one of those fuel lines at a gas station in central Beirut.
So we're standing outside the gas station that has pretty major artery of Beirut running past it, but that road is mostly blocked by a line of cars and a line of motorbikes that are all waiting to get fuel.
People start waiting in line before dawn, hours before the gas station even opens. The World Bank says this country is now in one of the worst economic crises anywhere in the world since the 1800s. For 11 months, Lebanon's politicians, seen as corrupt and dysfunctional, have failed to form a government or force through economic reforms. The local currency has collapsed, and banks have frozen withdrawals on dollar accounts, meaning people can't get their own money. Lebanese who were used to a Western lifestyle of nice cars and holidays abroad can barely make ends meet. We go to a once crowded shopping district of Beirut where there are now almost no customers. We meet Ifat, the owner of a clothes store. She says she's too embarrassed about her situation to give us her last name.
You go to the supermarket, you can't buy anything. Either the item you do find, you will be shocked from the prices.
She breaks down into tears.
We've never passed through this before. Really. People used to have money. Now you have nothing. Which is really terrible, isn't it?
State electricity only works for a few hours a day. Generators used to plug the gap, but now there's not enough fuel to power them all the time.
No electricity!
How much electricity you have in your house right now? We sweat in the night because there's nothing in the night.
Oh, we cannot sleep. We cannot sleep. Either you walk on the balcony waiting for the electricity to come or for the generator just to have for a couple of hours of sleep. That's it. No water? What else? Really, what else? It's a hell.
Water companies don't have fuel for the pumps. In the once crowded restaurants, food rots in warm fridges. Hospitals have cut air conditioning in all but the most critical wards. And the United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, says 70% of Lebanese now don't even have enough money to always buy food. Like Mahmoud Sabra, he's a private chauffeur for a family. He says his wife and three children have moved in with her parents in a different city because they can no longer afford the rent in Beirut. Sometimes they have to skip meals. Meat is a luxury. Sabra says his son told him the other day he was dreaming of a chicken sandwich. He says life today is not living. It's humiliation. Lebanon's leaders have asked to be bailed out by foreign countries, but the international community has seen help in the past squandered by incompetence and corruption. They want major reforms which the politicians won't implement. So for now, Lebanon is on its own. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Beirut.
And later today on All Things Considered, Colombian nationals are among the suspects in the assassination of Haiti's president. Colombia has an ongoing industry of former military personnel marketing themselves as mercenaries. We'll take a closer look today on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Callum Borchers.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.